morning, everyone. We'll have just a short pre-lab today because I want to make sure that you have time to complete your experiment and also for as many of you as possible to get through characterization for the experiment. Before we return to the lab proper, I just want to talk a little bit about oxidation state and formal charge. I know that that topic came up last time because I wanted to verify that this reaction that we're doing is an oxidation reaction. So we had talked about the oxidation states for carbon. So we must have gotten into this difference, but I wanted to write this down because I know that we had gotten this topic last quarter, but there are a few new students, but I also want to make this a formal reminder then for the older students that you need to know this difference between what oxidation state and formal charge is. They are both just counting systems. They are both counting systems in which the number of electrons actually around the atom is compared to how many that atom would have in its unreacted state. The difficulty comes from what to do with bonds, which we must have talked a little bit about polarity last time, and what to do about the fact that bonds have some polarity to them. So there are two extreme ways that we look at bonding. One is ionic bonding, where we imagine that electrons are completely transferred from one atom to another. And then we have covalent bonding, in which in theory they're supposed to be equally shared between each other. Well, in most organic compounds, the reality is somewhere in between, where we do have this sharing of electrons that occurs, which is why we characterize those bonds with things like sigma and pi bonds. But at the same time, there's an imbalance in charge there. So they're not completely 100% shared covalent bonds. And so if we're trying to count how many electrons there are there, that's why we have these two different systems that, again, view this these bonds as two extremes. One case is to view a bond as if it's ionic, which means that whichever of the two atoms is more electronegative owns, you could say, the electrons associated with that bond, just for the purposes of counting. When we did that bond-breaking exercise last time, that wasn't to try to imply at all that's how it reacts necessarily. That was just our way of figuring out where electrons went, because that is the way we did it for oxidation state, giving the electrons to the more electronegative element. For formal charge, which is what we use when we write structures, because when we write structures, we write them as if they're covalent bonds. For formal charge, we consider all the bonds covalent, which means that every case where you have a bond, one atom gets one electron and the other atom gets the other. The one wrinkle is that if you have a bond between two equivalent atoms, then even for oxidation state, we would divide the electrons up that way, each atom getting one electron, because neither would be more electronegative than the other. So let me write down this difference. Got the fact that these are both counting systems, but oxidation state treats bonds as if they were ionic. meaning the atom that is more electronegative receives the electrons for the bond. I'll go ahead and put the exception here, and that's except when the bond has two of the same element, in which case the electrons are evenly divided. That's oxidation state. Formal charge is where all bonds are treated as fully covalent. So the electrons in the bonds are always given half to each atom. Now, we can do formal charge the way we did it last time, which is where in each case we look at an atom, we see what's connected to it, we break the bonds appropriately, and we count electrons. Except after some time, we do notice some patterns that develop. For example, any time that you have an oxygen connected to carbon, oxygen's going to automatically end up with both electrons of however many bonds are present. So for each bond with oxygen, essentially, oxygen's taking one electron away from carbon, and so each oxygen there in turn would cause the carbon to have a plus one oxidation state. Similarly, if we had a hydrogen, in every case where a hydrogen would be attached to carbon, the opposite would occur, because carbon's more electronegative than hydrogen, and so each time by having a hydrogen there, that effectively makes carbon have a negative one oxidation state. So if you had methane with four hydrogens, carbon would be negative four, one due to each hydrogen. If you had somehow four oxygens connected to carbon, then you'd have a plus four oxidation state because you'd lose all the electrons to the surrounding oxygens. So if you're trying to figure out an oxidation state for carbon, you can do it by this shortcut of still evaluating all the bonds that are around, but instead of going through the process of actually drawing the electrons in, just recognizing every time that you have a more electronegative element attached, that causes a plus one on carbon. Every time you have a less electronegative element attached, that causes a negative one on carbon. And then if you have a carbon attached, then that counts as zero, because that would come under the case where each carbon would receive exactly half the electrons from the bond. So let me write that shortcut. So the shortcut is each atom more electronegative than carbon. So each atom more electronegative than carbon causes carbon to have a plus one oxidation state per bond. So if you had a double bond with oxygen, that would count for a plus two. And this is not the, this should not be used in the way where we used to add charges or oxidation states together and make everything balance out to zero. This is already taking that into account. So if you see an oxygen, you say plus one. If you see a double bond to oxygen, you say plus two. Reverse is true for things that are less electronegative. That if we have carbon, again, it's as if it doesn't count. It doesn't cause plus or minus. So in the future, we'll use this simplified way of looking at things to more rapidly come up with oxidation state, which we're going to need to do since we're talking about oxidation as our lecture topic today. So questions, one on the difference between how you tackle formal charge and oxidation state, or any questions on these slightly simplified ways of determining carbon's oxidation state? This could really count for both lecture and lab, what we've done so far, because this is determining oxidation state. Now let's flip Fermi into lab, though, because let's review what it is that you need to do procedure-wise. So if you did not end up with enough time to stir last time, you're going to, the first thing off is continue the heating and stirring. You then have the two layers that you're supposed to separate, which... If we needed to, I could load up on the computer. I have the notes online, which if you don't have them with you, you could look, but we drew out the flow chart that day, showing how to separate the layers, and then also showing the washes, what to do with a wash, which at least let me remind you of that part. It did turn out that the organic layer was the top layer in this experiment, didn't it? Based on what you all saw, did the top layer end up being the organic layer? Nobody knows? Nobody got that far? I'm presuming it is, so just double check that it is, but acting on the belief that it is, each time you do a wash, it's going to be that top layer that you retain in the separatory funnel. So you transfer your organic layer in, transfer the wash in, the aqueous layer. You do the venting, shaking back and forth until you're done it a couple times, let the layers redevelop, and then drain out just the bottom layer, which again should be the aqueous layer. Just as a reminder that things don't drain as well if you don't take the cap off, because as liquid drains out, air needs to replace that volume. So make sure you take off your caps as you're draining out of your separatory funnels. And then those aqueous layers, we have the aqueous laced over there. Then for any of the organics, once you're done later, then we're going to have a separate bottle for that. You'll have three different washes, one of which is... The first one was sodium bicarbonate, and that's to remove excess acid. The second one, sodium bisulfite, that's to remove bleach. Third one, sodium chloride, to help encourage ionic impurities to be forced out. But then we didn't really talk much past that. So what happens after that point? You're drying it, which, just as a reminder, how do you know that you have enough drying agent? Or even first, is it appropriate to use your drying agent? Because if you see two layers in whatever flask that you're about to add drying agent to, that lower layer is almost invariably water, again, presuming the top layer is organic. It doesn't really do any good to add a drying agent to something that's got water in it, because that much water is going to require that much drying agent just to remove, and then you still have the organic layer that you're trying to dry out. So if in all your transfers and dryings and washings or whatever, you end up at the point where you're about to put in the drying agent and you have two layers, take that bottom water layer out first. Much more efficient to do that. To get that out, you can just use the tip of a pasture pipette and get it down into the bottom of your flask. Then you add drying agent. How do you know you've added enough? Well, it's kind of hard to know if you've added enough, but it's possible to know if you've added too much. Because if you've added drying agent and there's water there, usually it clumps up to make pretty tight little clumps. If you have remaining powdery drying agent, though, that means it did not absorb water, which after you've shook it around for a few minutes, if you still end up with some that hasn't clumped together, that means it's most likely already reacted or contacted the water, and therefore you have some excess reagent left over. That lets you know you added enough drying agent. You're then supposed to filter that, aren't you? Which we'll use a filter pasture pipette. Which last quarter, students, do you all remember how to do a filter pipette? If you could assist the students that are new, or new students, if you can't find anybody that can help you, let me know and I'll show you how to do it. But just to save time, since most of you are familiar, and even the new people are probably familiar with that, I'll just skim over that for now. What are you supposed to do after you filter, dry and filter that solution? So you're supposed to do a distillation, except we really don't have the time to do this distillation. And what solvent is it that you extracted with anyways? Diethyl ether. So now, by not doing the distillation, it is possible, if the reaction did not go 100% successfully, we may have some leftover alcohol. The idea in doing the distillation is that the ketone is more likely a lower boiling point than the alcohol, because the alcohol has the OH group for hydrogen bonding to occur. So if we didn't have a completely successful reaction, by not doing distillation, the alcohol will be present. But then we'll be able to verify that, much like we did last quarter, which is that if we have a reaction where the alcohol ends up still present, we'll see that big, huge OH peak, that characteristic one in the IR spectrum. Whereas if we completely convert it to a ketone has a very, almost as characteristic peak, but a much sharper peak, somewhere roughly around 1700 for this kind of compound. So big, broad peak at the 2900, 330, 200 mark, that you've seen last quarter as the presence of an alcohol. A sharp, non-rounded peak, more in the 1700 range, that's a carbonyl. So we want to see that carbonyl peak in the product. We don't want to see the alcohol, and that's what we're going to be analyzing for. Yes? We're not going to do the distillation. Instead, what we're going to do is to simply heat off the ether. Now I'm going to cross my fingers and hope this works. Yes. Oh my goodness, you're kidding me. Well, we don't have vacuum, but ether evaporates easily. So you're just going to have to heat the solution up for a while to boil the ether off. And then it is a solid product, right? So that's why you're recrystallizing. So once you've boiled off the ether, you're going to have to let it cool down enough to make sure that you've got a product. I'll scream at whoever I can to see if we can get the vacuum system on in time for us to do vacuum removal. But you'll just have to heat. You'll be able to smell the ether. I don't advise you sitting around sniffing your ether flask, but if you were to carefully waft some of the flask towards you, you could tell if that ether smell is present. Once you can detect no more ether, you let the flask cool down, you should get a solid, and then you could recrystallize. Yes? Well, that's why I'm saying that if we don't do it, that's why we might have alcohol as a side product. But boiling, even if we started to set up it now, we would barely get through the distillation today. Ketone's much higher boiling point than the ether, though. It's got to be considerably higher, given how many carbons are there. So unless we were really overheating it, I wouldn't worry about the ketone disappearing. So, and then once we do have the solid, we're going to be doing KBR pellet IR solid, just like we did last quarter for solid samples. Yes? No, you should go ahead and recrystallize. Yes, if you get an easily isolatable solid just by evaporating off the ether, go ahead and recrystallize, because that would also increase our chances of getting a pure compound. And then do an IR. And if you don't do the IR today, no problem. We do have next time that while your experiment is cooking, that you can then line up and do the IR. And as far as recrystallization, reminder of how best to conduct one of those, you're going to have your target compound and the solvent you're going to recrystallize with side by side on a hot plate. Heat both of them up to the point where the solvent is boiling. You might have your solid melt. So remember that as you're doing this, you're trying to make sure that you don't end up with two liquid layers, because that means you have something melted but not dissolved. So you heat up the solvent, you transfer a little bit of the solvent into the solid at a time. You're doing that because you want to stop that transferal at exactly the point where the solid does completely dissolve. Or again, if you end up with two liquids, where the two liquids merge into one layer. As soon as you've barely added enough of the solvent where you get to that point where everything's dissolved, then you take it off the heat, allow it to cool down to room temperature first, then put it in the ice bath, and then you should get your crystals, which we are going to need the vacuum if we're going to Hirschmuckel. So I guess I better go right away and yell at them to get it working again. Questions about what you need to be doing, though? Yes? Okay, so it does mention a side procedure of creating a derivative. I don't think we're going to have the time for the derivative. I'll say go ahead and save your products in case we come back to do that, because we are going to talk about creating those derivatives, but I remember an experiment later in the quarter it might be better us to do that with. So other questions then? So continue your heating if you need to. Once you're done with that, you're going to be doing your washes, then dry and filter, and then hopefully by that time we'll have the vacuum up again by then. If not, again, we'll just do an atmospheric pressure heating of your mixture to keep off the ether, and then hopefully again the vacuum be on so you can eventually get your crystals by first filtration. Now, if you don't finish today, then again, we'll just continue whatever leftover work you have next time, but you do have a pre-lab due next time. Let me go ahead and pull that up so I can confirm which portion of it that we're doing. The second experiment is reduction, so the opposite of what we just did. The theory part starts on page 563. The experimental procedure, or the further description of it, starts on 581. We are, again, doing just the mini-scale procedure, and I'll say that we'll do it at the quantities quoted. So skip the microscale procedure and skip the discovery, like the optional experiment that's at the end. So only write up the reduction of the 9-fluorinone itself. All right, let's go ahead and get to work.